of our session. And before we go any further, I would like to welcome our newest member of this committee, Senator Findley, the newest member of the Oregon City. Welcome, sir. You're a revenue veteran from the House.
Thank you. I appreciate that. I have a lot of passion for this committee. I like it a lot, so thank you.
Yeah. I appreciate you being on time. You're 7 hours away, and I'm less than an hour away, and I'm late.
I wasn't going to say that because you're the chair.
You weren't going to say that. You're polite. And we do have that unwritten. It's kind of an unwritten rule that new members often bring gift baskets.
Well, we had them at 8:30, and then it left. So, okay. Yeah, it was very expansive. I think everyone really enjoyed them. So sorry I missed it.
All right. Let's look at some committee rules, if anybody has any questions. Senator Findley?
I would make a recommendation that we adopt the rules as submitted.
Senator Findley moves that we adopt the rules as submitted. Are there any objections? Seeing none, committee rules are adopted. We have two issues today that are relatively obscure to most people, but critically important to the state. The first one is the broadcaster's bill, which is really kind of a misnomer for the taxpayers that are involved here. There's probably, what would you say, Caitlin, fewer than 20 taxpayers involved here, and those include Disney, HBO, and those kinds of large companies, mostly based outside of our state. And we've been looking at this issue for a long time, trying to figure out the best method to tax what consumers digest, I guess is one word to say, in this state. Over the last 5 years, we've changed that method, and that change recently sunsetted just last month. And so unless we do something, we go back to what we were doing, so-called audience method from 5 years ago. And I want to make it clear that while the legislature has punted this issue a few times now, doing nothing is also making a very clear policy choice of going back to this old method with that language. And so my hope is we make some clear choices this time, even if doing nothing is that choice. But I think we can do better than that. And at the very least, we need to catch up with the technology. We have this industry has changed dramatically, to say the least. Streaming TV, 5-10 years ago, there was no such thing. Streaming TV was, if you were in your backyard and somebody had their TV up too loud up the street, this TV was streaming into your backyard. So we need to modernize these statutes, and I thank you for your indulgence, committee, because this is a very difficult issue to understand, but it's critically important. We're going to do an informational hearing because we're a few minutes shy of the 24-hour notice that would put us in the public hearing zone, so that's why it's listed as an informational meeting and not a public hearing. So with that stage set, I think, Caitlin, you could focus a little more and set the stage better than I did.
Chair House, members of the committee. So I think Senator House did a good job describing kind of the background of the bill. I'll focus on the amendments that are before you. So the -1 and -2 amendments both replace the bill entirely. So I'm going to start with the -1. What this does, it adds to statute some updated definitions related to the industry. Like Senator House mentioned, some things are kind of outdated or misnomers now after the change. So this adjusts language to be more reflective of current times. The main policy change here is that it changes the calculation of the numerator of the sales factor to be the greater of one or two things. And I actually made a quick chart that I think we can hopefully get up here, and it will kind of highlight the choice that comes up for broadcasters under this policy. One option is to use the commercial domicile method for sourcing receipts, which is what we've been doing since 2014 to 2019. The other option that's going to be presented is using a kind of a gross receipts approach, where we take 0.4% of advertising and licensing receipts, and then we add to that direct consumers. So this is for the -1. This would apply to all broadcasters. And what happens is when they're calculating the numerator of the sales factor, they use the greater of these two things. So whichever one is larger, that will make up the numerator. The first, like I said, is sourcing, basically how they've been sourcing the past 5 years under commercial domicile, meaning that wherever the advertiser, the licensing agreement, or the direct subscriber is located or headquartered, that's where the sales get sourced. Or they will take 0.4%, so 0.004, multiplied by the domestic advertising and licensing receipts, and then they would add to that the direct subscriber receipts. And so the reason the direct subscribers are being added directly is because those are easier to identify in terms of sourcing. If an individual is a direct subscriber and they have an Oregon address, 100% of that sale would go to Oregon. So that's the dash one. The dash two, if we can just go down a page on this handout, the dash two basically takes the dash one and adds in another option. So the kind of top panel on this diagram is the same as the last slide, but now it only applies to broadcasters. And in the dash two, another type of entity called a platform broadcasting company is defined, and then it gives them an option to do what broadcasters are doing. So those two options we saw before, or to use the audience method that they've been in prior. So option two, the dash two gives more options than the dash one, but for this specific area or specific type of company. And then the dash three is the really kind of simple one. All it does is change the effective date, the applicability date from January 1, 2021 to January 1, 2020. As Senator Haas mentioned, if the committee doesn't take action, we will go back to audience method. So audience is current law. When the bill was originally drafted, if it was applicable starting on January 2021, we would have 1 year of audience and then the policy choice moving forward. So that's just kind of a technical change. And I think that's all I have.
Okay, and the dash threes came from, are those committee amendments?
Yeah, the dash three is a committee amendment.
Mm-hmm. Okay. You know, all of these are committee amendments. The dash ones were, I think, put forward by the Motion Picture Association. Do you guys want to come up first?
Good morning. Make sure this on. Okay. Good morning, Chairman Haas and Vice Chair Finley and members of the committee. My name is Melissa Patak. I'm Vice President and Senior Counsel for State Government Affairs for the Motion Picture Association, and I'm here on behalf of MPA and our member companies, who are the owners of most of the major television broadcast networks and most of the national cable program networks currently operating in the U.S. So let me just make it clear, we're here in support of the dash two, and I'll explain what that is. So we're very supportive, and thank you for addressing this issue over multiple years. SB 1529, the dash two, provides a fair and equitable method for taxing broadcasters. It builds on the apportionment system we've had since 2014 by providing a floor or a minimum with customer location, or what's often referred to as commercial domicile. And it'll work as Ms. Harger explained. Broadcaster will calculate their tax in accordance with the customer location apportionment method. Their gross receipts from advertising are in Oregon. If the advertiser is domiciled in Oregon, the broadcaster's gross license fees are in Oregon if the licensee is domiciled in Oregon. And a broadcaster's receipts from direct customers or subscribers are included if the customer, that subscriber, is located in Oregon. And then to determine the floor, the broadcaster will multiply 0.4%, 0.004, by the total amount of gross receipts of the broadcaster from advertising and licensing throughout the U.S., and then receipts from direct customers or subscribers in Oregon would also be added. So if the amount in A is less than B, the broadcaster will use the amount in B as the numerator, and that would be a larger amount. And then also, as part of this compromise, the dash two includes a provision allowing a platform broadcasting company to elect audience as its apportionment method. And so the question naturally arises, what is a platform broadcasting company? It's a cable service provider, a direct broadcast satellite service, or a multi-channel video programming distributor. So in providing for this election, for broadcasters that would be commonly owned with a cable service provider or a direct satellite broadcast company or a multi-channel video programming service provider, the bill addresses the changes that have occurred in the broadcast industry from business mergers to the development of these new streaming services. The bill retains audience as the apportionment method for those companies with the various business units that are commonly owned in order to streamline the determination of their tax liability. So we've estimated that under this formula, which does allow for some choices, the amount of tax paid by the affiliated broadcast entities will increase to more than $8.9 million annually, and that is a substantial increase over the amounts paid under what has been the commercial domicile method since 2014. The bill also modernizes the definition of broadcaster, provides a definition for platform broadcasting company, and these all reflect business operations, and they're intended to address the controversies that have arisen in past years. So we think this is a fair and equitable way. It provides consistency and clarity both for the state and for the taxpayer, and we hope and urge your support for SB 1529, and I'm happy to answer questions.
I'll ask you guys and maybe Caitlin. In past years, like going back 5 years, Nexus was an issue. In other words, some of these taxpayers weren't paying anything. They were just put on the radar. And now that tends to be not the case because of some court decisions. How does that change this whole dynamic?
So Nexus was an issue, and in some of the litigation, which is pointed out in the LRO report, Nexus remains an issue in some of those discrete cases. But based on the legislation that we've had since 2014, the broadcasters have all been filers. Then you add on the United States Supreme Court decision in 2018 called Wayfair, and we believe that Nexus is no longer an issue, should not be contested, and that broadcasters have been filing since 2014 and will continue to file.
Caitlin, you didn't mention this in your presentation. Nexus.
So, Senator Haas, members of the committee, I didn't talk about Nexus in my presentation. I think that might be a question for Chris, just given all the legal background, or possibly for LC, depending on where things are.
Okay. We'll get to that. Are you maintaining that if we made this change now to the amendment, the dash twos, that in this tax year, 2020, the collection taxpayers here will pay more than what they paid in 2019?
Yes.
Is that because of the change in the law or because there are more taxpayers now?
Well, it would be if we make this change, the 0.004 will yield more revenue to the state because the B will usually, sometimes, you know, would be more than the A, so they would be paying the greater of, and so that yields, on the natural, more revenue for the state of Oregon.
But in past years, though, I'm just saying because of Nexus, there weren't as many taxpayers.
Right. So the number of taxpayers, may change. We've had mergers, so there may be fewer entities, but the broadcasters haven't gone out of business. In other words, their ownership may change, so there may be fewer taxpayers, but the amount of revenue is still, probably increasing. But so we haven't lost any cable networks. You know, there's still ESPN, there's still HBO, there's still Comedy Central. All of them still, are still around. Ultimate ownership may have changed in the last couple of years because of some mergers and acquisitions and changing corporate ownership.
And what would you say is the strongest reason not to go back to audience, even if we updated the language to make up for the technology?
Right. So we just think this, the way it's laid out in SB 1529 captures the nature of the business today and the way broadcasters operate and how they're organized. And it's just, it's in line with what other states have been doing as well. And it's just a more modern and it reflects audiences on its own, as the only method of apportionment, is something that dates from the 80s, and it's just not reflective of the business organization the way it operates today.
Have you worked with the department in trying to conjure up a...
So we've worked with the LRO, and we know that we worked very diligently with them, as they worked very diligently in the fall on that report. And we know they talked with us, and they also talked with the DOR. We haven't conferred directly with DOR, but I think as LRO has been a bit of a, I don't know if honest broker is the right term, but really has solicited, I think, all of the relevant information. And we've really appreciated their working with them on this. And we appreciate your diligence, your time as well on this complicated issue.
And you got to the 0.4% how?
Trying to find a way to produce some more revenue for Oregon that still made it a fair and equitable tax system. Trying to demonstrate that, you know, a willingness to provide more revenue to the state, understanding that there was some dissatisfaction with the commercial domicile method. So it was kind of some internal discussions and some calculations and saying, well, what would be reasonable and manageable for the companies as well, but yet provide something that was substantial for the state.
Any other questions, committee? Okay. Thanks for your testimony.
Thank
you. Your initial testimony. Maybe have you on standby.
Yes, and we're here to answer any questions as this process unfolds, and we appreciate your efforts.
Thank you. Deanna Mack from the Department of Revenue.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, Deanna Mack, Department of Revenue. With me is Marilyn Harbor from Department of Justice, who's here to answer any questions that you may have about any of the litigation we've been hearing about over the last few years, as well as the Dash 1 and Dash 2 amendments. But I'm here today to talk about the changes to the interstate broadcaster special apportionment method of sourcing income to the state for corporate income and excise tax purposes, and whether changes are needed. So first, to understand whether changes to broadcaster apportionment is necessary, you must first understand what current law is for most other corporations doing business in Oregon, and whether those laws that apply to everyone else should also apply to this industry. So this is where we get a little bit into the complexity of some of the corporate tax stuff. The standard method for apportionment for corporations doing business in Oregon is modeled after what's called the Uniform Division of Income for Tax Purposes Act. You hear us call it UDITPA over the years. So we have adopted pretty much that in Oregon law. Any corporation doing business in Oregon that does not receive special designation by statute or carve out must apportion in accordance with UDITPA. Okay. So for years prior to 2018, UDITPA corporations doing business in Oregon were required to source sales of intangibles according to where the greatest cost of performing that intangible service was, where the income producing activity was, whether it, when it occurred both in and out of Oregon. So this required taxpayers to assign to the state the greatest, to the state that had the greatest proportion of their income producing activity. Under Oregon law, though, at the same time, goods were sourced to where they were delivered. So there was an inconsistency between how we treated goods, tangible and intangible. And as a result, this committee may remember in 2017, we talked about why that law needed to change. The treatment, of course, prior to 2018 caused unequal treatment between goods and services when each sector was making use of Oregon in the same way. Additionally, having those differences created what's called nowhere income. Some states used market-based sourcing, other states used cost of performance, and that meant that states would source income to the other state, and it would cause no one to tax it. So we came to the and this actually became a big deal once you guys passed the single sales factor apportionment in 2005. It became much more magnified. So as a result of most states moving to single sales factor, the Multi-State Tax Commission worked on model legislation and regulations to address the issue. So for tax years beginning on or after January 1, 2018, this body amended Oregon law to require that these taxpayers use market-based sourcing based on the model MTC statute. And under market-based sourcing, sales are generally sourced to the location where the service is delivered. Okay, and most states, there's quite a number of states that are moving towards that, which is consistent now with how goods were treated, right? So they also, the MTC also adopted model regulations, which we adopted nearly verbatim. However, we did reference the carve out for interstate broadcasters that we've been talking about. So the statutes that in the dash, the introduced version in the dash one that are being suggested to be repealed would actually align us with the all of them with the market-based sourcing provisions that you adopted in 2017. So the current law is a carve out from the provision of UDTPA for interstate broadcasters. So for tax years 1990 to 2013, Oregon, you know, at the request of the Oregon Broadcasters Association, required that taxpayers that engage in this for-profit business use an audience or subscriber method, right? We've talked about that. So those at the time, between 1990 and 2013, were all the alternative was cost of performance. So in this change, this time frame between 2014 and 2019, you all have adopted what's market-based sourcing for everyone. And so we went through some changes, you know, in 2014, and I know Caitlin has talked about that for you over the years as well. But we do not believe that the commercial domicile method of apportionment is consistent with market-based sourcing, where for the sale of a service, the receipts are sourced to the state in which the service is delivered. For instance, under the commercial domicile method, receipts from an advertiser customer domiciled in New York would be sourced to New York. However, under market-based sourcing, the receipts from an advertiser would be sourced to the state or states in which the advertisement is delivered. Even advertising receipts from an Oregon company that uses advertising agencies that are commercially domiciled in, say, California or New York, where most of them are, those would not be sourced to Oregon because those are domiciled outside of Oregon. So since 2018, because the legislature enacted market-based sourcing provisions for the majority of companies, and MTC model regulations have been adopted to address current business models of broadcasters and other similar business types, we believe there's no longer a need for a separate carve-out for broadcasters. In fact, the current carve-out, we think, captures too many types of companies that send electronic signals, but do so for other reasons, because technology and business models are changing for everyone, for all taxpayers in our current mobile economy. So from the department's perspective, we believe that the most precise apportionment method for interstate broadcasters that fairly and accurately reflects their activity in Oregon and the benefit they receive from the Oregon economy is market-based sourcing. Specific industry provisions are addressed under the MTC model regulations that we have already adopted as of 2018. The introduced version of the bill, as amended by the Dash 3, removes that carve-out and treats all taxpayers similarly situated the same using market-based sourcing. So if you have any questions or have anything for Marilyn, we're happy to answer any.
That was a lot.
I know. Sorry about that.
Maybe it's sometimes helpful for us if we have a hypothetical. So let's use a national company. Let's call it Netflix. And how would, under the methodology or the method you seem to prefer, the market-based source, if we go to that, I think it's the threes, how would they pay under this idea?
They have subscribers, Mr. Chair, and so they would use the subscriber method under the model MTC rules. And everyone can confirm that. But
yes, that's right.
there's a specific provision in the model regulations that it says services delivered to the customer on behalf of a customer or delivered electronically through the customer, which is much of what the issue has been here. It's directly addressed in the MTC model rules.
So they have subscribers, so you would take the apportionment through audience. What's that calculus look like, just so we could get a better understanding?
Marilyn, do you
want to introduce me? I'm Marilyn Harbor from the Department of Justice. You would look at the subscribers in Oregon versus the subscribers everywhere. And what that does is take a portion of the business receipts, the total unitary business receipts, and determine what portion should be assigned to Oregon for taxation. And if they're doing the same thing everywhere, it's a fairly simple concept. You just take a piece of what they're doing throughout the United States and assign it to Oregon. And right. Using the audience.
So like that would be 1% somewhere in there, and that's...
Well, the Oregon population is 1% of the United States population.
Yeah, but that's how you arrive at that, and that's...
Using the actual subscriber information may indicate a slightly higher amount, but it would be roughly in that area, that vicinity.
Now, the other side has famously pointed out that this is unfair because sometimes, maybe not Netflix, but Disney has theme parks or other activities, and it'd be unfair to put those in the pool too because there are no theme parks in Oregon or any of those other activities. There are listeners or viewers of Disney films, mm-hmm. but it's unfair to lump all of their operations into that pot. What is the
counterpoint? Well, there are two things to think about. The theme parks are themes because they are themes of the motion pictures and the TV shows that these companies are broadcasting. So it's very integrally, it's an integral part of the unitary business. And it's no different than any other business that you can think of. I don't know, Boeing, to use a totally different example, may have buildings in different, or plants in different areas, but they still do business in the state of Oregon. And it's the integrated operation of that business that produces the unitary business income. And so the question is, what percentage should be assigned to Oregon? And if you look at how many airplane parts are sold here, then that is a way to measure Oregon's percentage of that total unitary business income. So in taking it back to Netflix, you want to know what percentage of the subscriber activity Netflix has throughout the entire country should be assigned here. And if it happened to be a company with theme parks, then that is just part of their unitary business income. There won't be anything in the numerator for it because that's not part of the measurement, but it is still part of the unitary business income.
Additionally, just to remind you about the differences between when states don't have uniformity, I mentioned earlier, it causes something called nowhere income. And so what happens when we have differences between us and other states, like California, for example, is an audience-based state. So if you're doing business in California, California will assign states based on where your viewers are, right? So that means they're assigning them to Oregon or they're assigning them to Idaho or wherever those businesses or wherever the viewers are. When you come to Oregon and you have a different method, like commercial domicile or some of the other states that are recently doing that, that we're going to say, no, it doesn't matter that the viewers are here. We're going to assign that back to California where the commercial domicile is. So what then happens is no one is taxing that income. And so that is an outcome when you have differences between states. And that's the purpose of the MTC uniformity model, to try and make sure that everyone understands across the state, practitioners prefer to have uniformity. State taxing authorities prefer uniformity. It helps with preparing returns. It helps with guidance like this, and it fairly and accurately reflects their income because something is taxed in every state.
Probably should have got to this earlier. Maybe Caitlin knows it, but just so we all know what the revenue impact is that we're talking about.
I think that Kate did provide that in a prior hearing based on just a small subset of taxpayers, and I feel like you had said it was $75 million over the period.
So, Chair Haas, members of the committee, I'm still working on the revenue impact for this bill because we're taking it kind of market-based versus audience or this new proposal versus audience. I don't have that updated. But in the LRO report, we did talk about kind of the differences, and I think it amounted to like $10 million a year, but there was a rounding, but that is in our report, and I can get that.
$10 million a year over the last few years?
Yes, so as a result of changing from audience to commercial domicile, there was a loss of about $10 million a year.
Okay, what's the total? That was a total paid over the last 2 years under domicile.
Oh, Chair, I do not know that off the top of my head, but I can get that for you later today.
Okay. Your problems with the dash twos?
Do you want to speak to the dash twos and dash twos?
Essentially, two problems. The definition of gross receipts that was removed in the dash two is what was at issue in the Comcast case that went to the Oregon Supreme Court. And so the dash two, in essence, overrules or replaces the Supreme Court's decision by removing all the gross receipts from apportionment and consideration in that formula. The in addition, the 4% does not reflect a, well, as we said, 1% of the population of the United States is in Oregon. And so it's highly unlikely that fewer people are watching these programs in Oregon than in every other state. And so we don't think that's directly, it doesn't fairly reflect the business done in the state. So those are the two main things.
Okay. Senator Finley? Any questions up here? Well, thank you. Thank you for coming up. We'll revisit this and keep you on standby. Thank you. John Calhoun, did you want to weigh in on this?
Chair Haas, Vice Chair Finley, members of the committee, my name is John Calhoun. I'm representing Tax Fairness Oregon. Our position is pretty simple. The industry changed. You had an experiment. The experiment's over. Continuing that experiment would cost us revenue. This proposal in 1529 adds revenue to the state. We like that. But it also is supported by Department of Revenue in terms of treating this industry similar to other service providers in the state, and they know how to implement it, so it seems like a good solution. We're not familiar with the complexities that you're trying to deal with in terms of the specifics of some of the options that you're looking at in the dash two.
Senator Taylor.
Thank you, Chair Haas. Just for clarity, your organization, are they what amendments are you supporting and not supporting?
We don't have a position on the dash two. We support the basic bill.
I'm just clarifying.
Yeah.
Okay. Thanks, John.
Thank you.
Seems like I've said this over and over on this bill. Committee, you have some homework to do as we try. My goal is to reach some sort of resolution on this issue this session. So. Thank you all. I'll close the informational hearing. another fairly straightforward and simple subject coming up here with Internal Revenue Code and disconnect and reconnect. This is kind of a biennial rite of passage, Kyle. This one doesn't seem to have any major controversies, so maybe you could set the stage for what we'd like to do here.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Yes, Senate Bill 1528, this is the annual reconnect bill that this committee sees each year. And the bill, just I'll try to keep it pretty brief. We do have the Oregon Society of CPAs as well that'll be coming up to describe the changes at the federal level that took place in the last year. But again, the connection point for Oregon, especially for the personal income tax and the corporate income tax, you can really think there's two connection points. The first being there's a rolling reconnect, and that's the connection to the federal definition of taxable income, and that's where Oregon's tax system begins with the federal tax system. So everything, all the federal laws that go into determining federal taxable income are automatically incorporated here in Oregon because we're automatically connected. So any changes at the federal level that change what is in taxable income, what is or is not taxable income, those are automatically incorporated here in Oregon. So the second connection is then what we refer to as these point-in-time connections, and that's what the bulk of Senate Bill 1528 is relating to. And it's a lengthy bill because there's a lot of different spots in statute where we update to a point-in-time connection. In the meeting materials, you'll find a section-by-section description of the statutes and what's been connected to, but the general way that this has been laid out is you can almost think of it, if I printed out the Internal Revenue Code as of December 31st, 2018, that's what Oregon's connected to right now. And then what's being updated in Senate Bill 1528 is we're updating from that December 31st, 2018 to December 31st, 2019. So you could print out 2018 and 2019, and they're gonna look pretty much the same in a lot of cases, but any changes that happened between that year, you'd now be connecting to the 2019 statute. But again, most of the changes and the changes that will be described by the CPAs generally are going to occur on that automatic connection to definition of taxable income. So what's in front of you here of the changes that we're updating to, an example might be a connection to what's the definition of a nonprofit. So that's related to the 501c3 definition at the federal level. We're just updating that a year. If there's no changes to the statute, there's no real change here in Oregon other than just updating our statute. In terms of the point in time, we do have a dash two amendment. There's really two parts to the dash two. The first is just updating some age changes, and this will be mentioned by the CPAs as well, that occurred at the federal level. This is related to PERS, and it's just updating Oregon statute. Having conversations with PERS, the federal tax changes of changing the age from 70.5 to 72, that already more or less is the controlling point for PERS. So what we're really doing here in this bill is just updating Oregon statute to reflect the federal changes. But the policy itself has already more or less been made at the federal level with that change. And then there's also in the dash two related to the Oregon's 529 program, making sure that our 529 program and the Oregon tax credit that's available for contributions to it align with the new federal changes. And again, I know that's in the list that the CPAs have as well, so I'll just leave it there and they can provide more context to what those two changes are to the 529 program. You do have testimony in the meeting materials from the treasurer's office as well, describing the 529 change there. And with that, Mr. Chair, that's my quickest high level overview.
Okay. Any questions, Kyle, before we ask the CPAs to walk us through their understanding? Okay, come on up. You have John Hawkins, Heather Jackson, and Gary Holcomb.
Chris, you want to do it?
We'll see. Sleep on.
Okay.
Morning.
Good morning, I'm Chair Haas, I'm Vice Chair Finley.
For the record, my name is Gary Holcomb. I'm a member of the OSCPA Taxation Committee. I'm a certified public accountant in public practice in Portland, and I appreciate the opportunity to be here and participate in today's hearing. On behalf of the 4,400 members of the OSCPA, we respectively testify today, and my colleagues will introduce themselves.
For the record, my name is John Hawkins, and I'm a member of the Oregon Society of CPAs Taxation Committee. I'm a certified public accountant here in Salem with the firm Grove, Mueller & Swank. Appreciate the opportunity to testify today.
Good morning, Chair Haas, Vice Chair Finley, and members of the Senate. I'm Heather Jackson. I am a member of the Oregon Society of CPAs as well, and I appreciate the opportunity to be here today.
So I'll go ahead and start. My first word says the book. We're used to presenting the book that you guys have. I guess we don't do books anymore, but we're still calling it that. We're really here to talk about two things that were passed very late in the year by Congress. It was December 20th of 2019. And those two acts were setting every community up for Retirement Enhancement Act, which is referred to as the SECURE Act. And the second act, which they passed on the same day, was the Taxpayer Certainty and Disaster Relief Act of 2019. So that's the Disaster Act. So we'll really go over those two. A lot of these changes are the same ones when we'll refer to these as extenders, and Heather will present quite a few of the extenders that we presented in years past. So some of the substantive changes in the past year, I think, are pretty light, and I think our presentation will be, you know, fairly shorter compared to some of the years. As legislative revenue staff tried to indicate, we do the same thing that he was describing. So our Section A is what he was describing. Oregon will automatically reconnect to all these provisions without any change on your part, without any action by the legislature. The Section B is those ones that doesn't really change the Oregon, but as he mentioned, you to update those changes to anything that has changed, you guys will need to take some act because they're not automatically adopted. We don't have any C recommendations this year. And then D are those ones where, you know, they don't impact tax law, but they're things like ERISA, employment law, that, you know, reference tax codes, but doesn't necessarily impact income or the tax code itself. And then finally, this year, we have something different when we have these ENFs, and those really were kind of the extenders in E that passed that Congress did extend, and those that are in F that Congress let expire. So, you know, if you have questions on any of these, like I said, we're going to skip through a lot of them, but we'd be more than glad to answer. As legislative revenue staff indicated, you know, we are tied to federal taxable income. There are a couple of changes that you guys have enacted over the years, such as, you know, disconnecting from Section 199A, some items with the 529 plans to make them compliant. So not everything is disconnected, you know, are connected automatically. The legislature has made choices in the past. You know, we believe that one disconnect may not have a large tax impact to taxpayer compliance, but many different disconnections or different connection dates can have a large impact on this. On taxpayers and tax preparers. So let me go I'm going to cover Section A with John here. And most of these in Section A, as you'll see, legislative revenue staff indicated that, you know, it impacted some of the PERS items. And these are really just items that we think Oregon is connected to that would impact you if you were, you know, putting money into a plan, pulling out of a plan, administering plans. So, you know, our recommendation would be to just automatically reconnect to these items. One I will cover, like, just that looks odd, is that second one, the certain non-tuition payments that are treated as compensation. Just so you understand that, it seems weird that you'd want to treat a stipend as compensation, but it's what that allows you to do. It doesn't necessarily put into taxable income for these graduate students. It lets them count it as income, which allows them then to make a contribution to an IRA so that they can start. So it seems kind of incongruous that you'd want it as compensation for these students, but it actually allows them to save. One of the ones that legislative revenue staff covered next was that repeal of the maximum age. I think there's some things there that, you know, there isn't a maximum age now to make IRA contributions. And the same kind of on those next page, the qualified employer plans, and, you know, when can you move some of those plans around and those provisions reflecting that. I think the last two I'll mention are on our page 12. And the first one here, the first one there is that qualified cash or deferred compensation arrangements. And that's basically allowing more part-time employees to be able to participate in these retirement plans. Instead of having to work 1,000 hours per year, you're allowed to work 500 hours per year and still be able to do that. The last one, I guess, this is what legislative revenue stuff, I referred to the wrong one before. This is where it says you don't have to begin making mandatory distributions until the age of 72. So I think, John, that's all I'm going to cover. Okay.
So I start on page 13. And again, some of these are fairly technical, narrow changes to qualification rules for retirement plans. And I guess our feeling is that if the IRS has something they deem to be a qualified plan, it would be very inconvenient if, under Oregon law, it was not a qualified plan or vice versa. So the community newspaper industry has been hit hard financially, so this allows community newspapers to make up shortfalls in their defined benefit plans over a period of time. People who provide foster care for individuals that are disabled to get a difficulty of care payment, which under tax law is treated as non-taxable, but similar to the stipends that Gary talked about with graduate students, that income is treated as income that would allow you to make a retirement plan or an IRA contribution. So that's on page 14. Page 15, currently you have to adopt, if you want to set up if a small employer or a new business wanted to set up a retirement plan, they would have to actually set up the plan document by the last day of the year, by December 31st. The provision at the top of page 15 allows employer to set that up by the due date of the tax return, including extensions. And this makes qualified plans like profit sharing and some other things like that more consistent with like a SEP, if some of you are familiar with those that a lot of small business owners have, the due date. It gives an employer more time to set up a plan, and you might not know what your profit is until after you, at the end of the year, you go see your accountant, and you know, he tells you you should have set up a plan. There are some narrow things here with volunteer firefighters, some exclusions from income, and at the bottom of page 16, change to 529 plans, and this is for distributions out of a 529 plan. This expands to allow distributions from a 529 plan to go to an apprenticeship program, and also allows a distribution from a 529 plan to pay off student loans to a lifetime maximum of $10,000. And this can also go to a sibling of the person that the 529 plan was, so you could pay off a sibling's student loan with money from a 529 plan. So page 17, this is one of the bigger, I think, changes that's gotten a lot of press, is that the rules for inherited IRAs have been substantially changed. And in the past, we've had some very complex rules that, you know, this set of rules, if the person died before they'd reached age 70 and a half and were doing required minimum distributions, or if the person was over age 70 and a half and were taking required minimum distributions, and who was named a beneficiary, and there was a lot of, I think, complexity with this rule. In certain circumstances, owners, beneficiaries of an inherited IRA could stretch out those payments over their lifetime. I know I've got a file on my desk where grandma died and one of her children had predeceased her, and some young grandchildren in their 30s are inheriting part of this IRA, and they're able to stretch out those payments for like 50 years. But under the new rule, there's going to be just a fairly simple blanket rule that says you got to take all the money out within 10 years. So there's just going to be a 10-year withdrawal rule for inherited IRAs with three exceptions. And one is the surviving spouse, one is if there are minor children, and the third is if there's disabled children. And we're not event, are we? No, you're okay. Take care of me. Good, thank you.
Excuse me.
Yes.
Thank you, Chair. So is that is this going forward or is that retroactive?
So this is going forward. This applies to deaths that occur after January 31st of 19.
Okay.
So for folks who have died in previous
years,
really
complicated.
Their grandfather did, huh?
I thought it was going to be very complicated to have to go back and redo all
those. Oh, it would be very complicated. So this applies to any deaths after December 31 of 19.
Okay.
And this last item here on page 18, generally, if you make an amendment to a retirement plan, you can't take away accrued benefits. It's called the anti-cutback rule. And this is saying that if you are an exception to the anti-cutback rule is if you're making an amendment that follows that you have to make because of either Treasury or Labor Department regulations. That's a fairly narrow technical rule. Okay. So I'm going to turn it over to Heather.
Righty. Heather Jackson here, and we're going to talk about recommendation B. Just a reminder, these are things that generally have no organ change necessary, as these are credits, penalties, administrative rules at the IRS level. On pages 20 through 23, just because these are all credits, penalties for withdrawal from retirement plans, you get penalty-free withdrawals for adoption or births, combined reporting for plans and groups, and increasing penalties are all covered in those three pages from 20 to 23, so those are really not super applicable to you guys. Page 24, though, has, just as an informational, is the kiddie tax. In January of 2018, the kiddie tax came into place with a change. Kiddies were now taxed at the trust rates, which are generally higher tax rates. That has been removed and effective 12/31/19. It will go back to what we've had as kiddie tax in the prior years, basically. Any questions on those? I know I went through them very fast, but a lot of those are not applicable to you guys. Okay. As we mentioned, there's nothing in recommendation C that we wanted to specifically call to your attention this year. So on to letter D.
So it's back to me for letter D. And these are some, I think, administrative matters, again, that would not impact Oregon. Requirements for annual disclosures to participants of a plan of what their annual lifetime stream might look like. There's a safe harbor here for exception to this prudent man rule for distributions of certain types of annuities and a reduction of the pension benefit guarantee corporations. There's an insurance you have to buy for defined benefit plans and reduces that for certain small employer charity plans. So again, administrative rules that do not impact definition of Oregon of federal taxable income. Okay.
On to recommendation E. This is done in a very much different format than we've ever done in the past. Basically, we've given you the credit or the code sections and the expiration dates because a lot of it is tied to the law that passed last year where it has 10 years to go. Some of them are, you know, changing every year to year, so we thought this would be a quick reference guide so you could see when things were updated, what is in and out of this 10-year rule versus what's being extended year by year by year. Basically, pages 30 and 31 are primarily tax credits. Again, not a ton of impact to you guys. But like on page 32, I just wanted to show you kind of what I was talking about for some, so you know kind of what this is about. The suspension of personal exemptions, the limitation on the $10,000 tax deduction on Schedule A, the personal loss limited to federal disaster areas. Those items all expire December 31st of 2025. The depreciation ones in the middle of the page, the 168 bonus depreciation, As you can see, a lot of those are December 31st, 2020 and 2021. So you kind of have a reference here to how and when these expire based on what they are. I didn't want to go through all of these pages, but this is kind of what is in and how what this is used for. Any questions on this?
I see the three-year depreciation for racehorses for 2 years old or younger expires next year.
Yeah, the bonus depreciation, a lot of the depreciation ones are year to year, but a lot of the big ones that we talked about last year are in that 10-year rule. And I can go through these if you'd like in more detail, but I kind of wanted to just give you a highlight and a summary of everything. Section or recommendation F is everything that expired in the last 2 years. So there's just a small handful of things that have actually expired and they've let go. So you have a short list of those for reference as well. I think this is the faster.
Yeah, Chair House, I think that's.
Oh, go ahead.
Yeah, right?
Yeah.
A lot of controversy there. You can see, though, hundreds of places where the state could disconnect if it wanted to. We're now on this list. We're ready to accept these things. Senator Findley, any comment?
I'm bummed out about the racehorse issues.
Yeah, I know. maybe you could work on.
No, I've gone through them. I think. I don't have any issues. Why would we want to disconnect? We ought to stay where we are.
Okay.
Other racehorses.
Any questions of the CPAs? All right. As usual, great job.
Thank you.
Thank
appreciate
you.
It.
Thank you.
I'm going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 1528. And I'll schedule, I think it's scheduled for a work session on Thursday. Well, with hopes of passing this onto the floor. Obviously, we'll be back at 1529 at a date undetermined. So thank you all, and we will adjourn.
Let's just relay it out well.
You guys are 2021.
Yeah, that would be great.